Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Epochs number 40 of the Lotus Eaters. I'm Bo Dade, and again I'm joined by the Masterful Apostolic Majesty. How are you, good sir?
Happy again to be here, and I'm very much honoured that you would consider me masterful. But, thank you, nevertheless.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. It's a pleasure just to pick your mind or wind you up and let you go. It's just great whenever someone's when someone's a talking head and they really know their stuff inside out. I mean, there's no substitute for that, in my opinion. So great stuff. I mean, let's just jump straight in. Last time we were getting up to sort of the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-1871. So I'll let you go however you want to go from here.
Yes, sure. So the details of the Franco-Prussian War aren't really pertinent to our discussion on the causes of World War I, but relaying this back to our causes of World War I. So obviously, the French declare war on Prussia. The Prussians are able to utilize all of their alliances over the previous 4 years, the North German Confederation, their alliances with Baden, Württemberg, and Bavaria, to bear all of German might, essentially, onto the French. The French are defeated very decisively. The Emperor and Napoleon III is overthrown. Paris is surrounded. The political situation in France becomes so unstable that you have a provisional government and you have a Paris Commune, which takes over control of the city, devastates and destroys a large part of Paris, including the Palais des Tuileries. The Prussians create Germany, or rather pronounce the creation of a German empire in the Hall of Mirrors in the Palace of Versailles as they're besieging the city of Paris. And the provisional government is finally able to restore some order in France, negotiate a rather humiliating peace treaty with Germany, in which they pay a vast sum of reparations. And they also cede the territories of Alsace and Lorraine to the newly established German Reich as their own little segmented provinces. So all in all, what are the effects of this war, and what are the implications for our understanding of World War I? Well,
sorry, AM, could I ask you a very quick question there?
Yes.
You know the Treaty of Versailles was signed in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles?
Yes, intentionally meant to mimic that and humiliate the Germans.
That's what I was going to ask. So, of course, the Palace of Versailles, Louis XIV's sort of grand master project. And so the Germans obviously very deliberately chose that as some kind of slap in the face in 1870, 1871 as their military headquarters. And I sort of suspected that maybe the 1919 Treaty of Versailles. So it was very deliberately done because of that.
Yes, Georges Clemenceau was very keen of the irony of that occasion, absolutely.
Right. Okay.
But that's your point. It establishes a keen atmosphere of French humiliation. And born out of this war for France is a word called revanchism, which meaning revenge, mainly about, not only taking back the provinces of Alsace and Lorraine, but also restoring France's position as the main power in Europe. Because that is, of course, the ultimate effect of this war, is that not only is France militarily defeated and loses territory and has to pay humiliating reparations, but now Germany, which hadn't existed before the war, is able to assert itself as the new major nation in Europe. And I want to bring this back to the Napoleonic Wars, because really, this is why Bismarck is, to my mind, almost a more interesting character than Napoleon, because Napoleon, in his endeavour to achieve more or less the same thing, French mastery over Europe, managed
to... Sorry, we are talking about Napoleon the First.
Yes, Napoleon the First, not Napoleon the Third, just to make that clear, was able to precipitate six coalition wars against him. He would impose very unfavorable peace treaties on his defeated partners, force them into unfavorable alliances, which obviously meant that the minute that the military situation of France deteriorated, all of his erstwhile allies turned against him and declared war on him, as is what happened with the War of the Sixth Coalition. But relaying this to Bismarck and the complete contrast between Bismarck and Napoleon, Bismarck was very aware of this fear of creating coalition wars. So what an aspect of the brilliance importance of Bismarck and what very could nearly have been a, you know, a First World War in the 1860s, is that from 1864 until 1871, Bismarck is able to localize all of these conflicts. He's able to ensure that the First War is fought against Denmark, the Second War is fought against Austria and her German allies, and the Final War is fought against France. Now, put this in perspective, because a lot of people make a lot of emphasis about German provocation being a key, you know, a key aspect of the lead up to World War I. Well, look at the provocation that Prussia has necessarily caused. Prussia has massively expanded its power. It starts off as probably the least of the great powers in Europe. And after a 7-year period, it is now the greatest of the great powers in Europe. In terms of deliberate Anglo provocation, they declare war on Denmark, which is nominally aligned to Britain. They annex Hanover, which had until very recently been seen as part of the royal English patrimony, because of course the kings of England, the kings of Great Britain, were also the electors of Hanover, and that was the case until 1837. But even so, the same family ruled in Hanover as ruled in Great Britain, and now we're seeing the defeat of France, which had been probably Britain's closest partner in terms of its imperial policy up until that point, militarily defeated and humiliated. And yet, unlike the situation of World War I, Britain does not intervene, nor does Russia, the other great power in Europe, intervene, nor does Austria intervene because of Bismarck's wise policy towards not wanting to excessively alienate her or damage her in the aftermath of the Seven Weeks' War. And of course, the Italians don't intervene either. So Bismarck has successfully achieved a massive reorientation of power in the European political system towards Prussia, towards Germany, without creating what Napoleon had done again and again and again, which is these wars of the coalition. And so this is important because when we look at World War I, so much of the emphasis of the causes of World War I is this idea of Germany precipitating this coalition against her expansionism, essentially. So I want to put this in perspective of 1860s as to how Germany was able to avoid said wars of the coalition, and again contrast this also with 1815 and France's ability before to precipitate coalition after coalition after coalition, which is all the more remarkable. What are the overall implications of this? Because we now have a new European order. I mentioned in the previous lecture, or rather sort of discussion, I don't mean to say lecture, that Metternich had convoked a new system of European power, which was primarily based on Austrian soft power. Austria's ability to negotiate and manage all of these various other great powers in a multipolar European order. Of course, the weakness of that is because Austria wasn't the dominant partner militarily in that. Russia could go its own way. Britain could go its own way. France had various revolutions destabilizing the political situation in France. And so by 1848, that system had temporarily unraveled. What is then remarkable is that after 1848, after the humiliation of Austria, Franz Josef comes in and he's able to restore Austria's position very briefly from around 1849 until 1859. Then we see France getting involved in a war in Italy. Austria is defeated. Austria is again defeated by Prussia. So by 1866, Austria starts off in 1859 as being this major diplomatic power in Europe. And now it's almost a secondary consideration in terms of the grand scheme of European affairs. By 1871, now that France has been defeated, it is now Prussia, Germany, which has taken over the role of Austria as that leading diplomatic power. And Bismarck assumes this this title, essentially, of the honest broker of the continent. So he has taken over Austria's role as essentially the diplomatic manager and the guarantor of European peace, which is all the more remarkable. With Napoleon, it was simply, I'm going to impose European peace by force. With Metternich, it's I'm going to achieve it via negotiation. With Bismarck, it's a little bit of a combination of the both. Bismarck doesn't have the overwhelming power that Napoleon had in 1812, yet he's also not quite as weak as Metternich was in 1815 throughout 1848 in terms of the raw power of Austria. So he has to therefore juggle all of these new European alliances to prevent another general European war, a general European conflagration. But there is a fundamental flaw in this whole plan, which is he is pissed off the French to no end. Unlike what we see with the Congress of Vienna, where France under Talleyrand, as you probably recall, was reconciled into the European system, France, as far as Germany is concerned, is now some sort of international pariah. And so Germany's new scheme of diplomatic alliances is now focused on destabilizing the situation in France, the fraught political situation after the Franco-Prussian War, and on ensuring there are no allies in Europe for France to build up any coalition against Germany in the future. So as far as Bismarck is concerned, he's won the game. Now it's simply a matter of maintaining German preeminence in Europe and preventing France from forming an alliance against its interests.
That's interesting. One thing I wanted to ask you about then is, we're just talking about Germany now. Is it, of course, it's not quite as simple as that. It's not Germany as we know it or anything. But I've heard it, you know, quite often described as sort of a Prussian-dominated Germany or something like that. Or sometimes people just still refer to Prussia, even though they're actually talking about that sort of proto-united Germany. Do you think after, at least after 1871, you can just talk of Germany?
That's a very interesting question, because my belief when understanding German unification is that Germany is not united as some sort of liberal political project in the way that they wanted to get rid of the old states, get rid of the old principalities, and replace it with some form of a new German administration with new provinces, etc. That's not what happens at all. Instead, what happens is that the leading economic and military power in Germany, in North Germany, Prussia, is able to contrive the unification of German states under its own, you know, authority, under its own hegemony, by these very sort of carefully planned wars instigated by Bismarck. What arises out of this is that we don't have one Germany. In many ways, we have two Germanies, because Austria still exists. And Austria, until 1866, was considered the principal German power. Right, and it had been considered the principal German power since the 15th century. All of a sudden, what we're now seeing is that Prussia has basically usurped that rank of the primary sort of German state away from Austria. And 4 years later, with the Franco-Prussian War, Prussia is able to consolidate that position even more. However, he doesn't want to alienate the Austrians either, for fear of building up another alliance, Austria, Russia, France, against him either. So even, you know, in terms of like the diplomatic considerations for this, when the Prussian king, Wilhelm I, is made, you know, the ruler of this new German state, he doesn't take the title Emperor of Germany. Instead, he takes the title Deutsches Kaiser, German Emperor, to identify he's simply one of two German emperors, the other being Emperor of Austria, Franz Josef. Now you have the Ausgleich, the Austro-Hungarian compromise, so that's become even more complicated. So he's not wanting to emphasize dominion over all the Germans. He's simply wanting to emphasize that he is a German ruler who has a preeminent position among all of the German princes except for Austria. And this is the idea of a little Germany under Prussia, or a greater Germany under Austria. Prussia has basically forced the issue and now created this little Germany, which has excluded vast German lands, German-speaking territories within the Austrian Empire, and indeed elsewhere in Europe.
It's very interesting, isn't it? I think perhaps for the 20th century or 21st century mind, people don't really think of how the Austro-Hungarian or the Austrian Empire was sort of thought of as more Germanic than Prussia, or those northern German states with their capital in Berlin. It's funny to think, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily more Germanic, but the first of the German princes. Yes.
Right, yeah. And you've got lots of them, because, of course, the king of Bavaria was important, and you had sort of the king in Prussia before the Prussian king. But it's fair to say, isn't it, that after 1871, Wilhelm I is... There's absolutely no question that he's the preeminent German king or emperor by that point.
Yes, and this is the remarkable situation about the sort of new German constitution. You've elevated the Prussian king, who doesn't sort of lose his title. He doesn't lose his title of being Prussian king. He is Prussian king and German emperor at the same time. But this also creates a new position for Bismarck. Before this point, Bismarck had been minister president of Prussia, and now he is, in addition to being minister president of Prussia, he is now the first German chancellor. which is a new position which he's created for himself. In addition to being German Chancellor, he's also head of the German Foreign Office, to make things even more convoluted. And there were these wonderful cartoons from the period, which you can go up and look, where you have Bismarck with all of these different uniforms representing all of the various hats he's constantly having to juggle, mm-hmm. with all these various duties and positions. Mm-hmm. So what is sort of interesting about the new constitution is that there is a lot of deference in this German Empire, or the Kaiserreich, to this idea of, you know, the princes having representation. There is a Reichstag, which has, suffrage, which has the right to vote. You know, ordinary people can vote in these elections to vote for parties in the Reichstag. And then you have this Imperial Federation, which is comprised of all the representatives of the princes. But none of these, nominally sort of powerful bodies has any real power. Most of the power still derives from the King Emperor, Wilhelm I. And he also has supreme command over the army, which is a very important point to mention. The army is not run by a civilian. The army is run by the monarch. Mm-hmm. And Bismarck is held in power in the center of this new system by managing all of these factions. And when, you know, he's, you know, lacking support from the king, he relies on parliamentary groups to support him, and vice versa. When he needs to push for reform, he relies on the king, and this the king and the emperor. And this, of course, proves fatal to him when Wilhelm II comes in 1888 and wants to embark upon his new policy, so to speak. So Bismarck's position is almost essential, yet it's also very precarious. There isn't anything as simple in Germany as an established, an all-powerful monarch, or a civilian government led by a parliament either. Instead, you have this mixed system with Bismarck juggling all of these different parts of the new German constitution.
Mm, mm. Two things there I paused on very briefly. One was that Bismarck's position was, correct me if I'm wrong here, but kind of obviously, maybe, I suppose, but very, very heavily dependent on the fact that he had the trust of Wilhelm.
Yes.
And there's lots of anecdotes about how he would manage him in various ways, bully him or browbeat him or guilt trip him or whatever, all those sorts of things. But how precarious that is, because if Wilhelm just decided one morning, right, I'm done with Bismarck, I'm going to get somebody else, I suppose he had the power to do that.
Go on.
I was just going to say one other just real quick thing is that you mentioned there that Bismarck also took on sort of the portfolio of foreign secretary, essentially. I think that's interesting. I think Lord Salisbury, I might be wrong about that, but one of our prime ministers in and around this time, a bit before, I think, also just took on, like I say, the responsibilities,
right,
the portfolio
you're completely right.
Of the foreign secretary. And it's funny because we don't really do that anymore these days. You know, used to have prime ministers that were from the Lords and all sorts of different things that we just don't have anymore. But it's interesting that Bismarck, I mean, it's probably one of the things that always gets said about him, but he did concentrate a lot of the powers in his own hands, didn't he?
Yes. Just to talk about your point you brought up about Wilhelm I having the power theoretically to dismiss him. I mean, just to lean on those anecdotes, I mean, Bismarck, you know, would throw lamps at him. He would break down in tears and have these incredibly, you know, grotesque, dramatic episodes where he would, you know, feign that he was doing all of this for the good of the German people. And he would have these wonderful episodes where he would, you know, call on the emperor, you know, I shall resign if I'm not given this position. And of course he tries to do this Wilhelm II, and Wilhelm II has none of this. He's backed up by his own coterie of sycophantic ministers and thinks he can rule without him. And of course he does, as you suggest, simply just dismiss him. Jonathan Steinberg, who's probably written the most sort of authoritative account of Bismarck in English, claims that Wilhelm I is the only ruler with which this system could have operated or worked. He wasn't a man who wanted to be king, but also he was a man who was humble enough to allow someone to rule on his behalf, so long as Bismarck would basically carry out what he wanted. And what Wilhelm essentially wanted was to maintain the monarchical system and to maintain the preeminence of the Prussian army in Prussian society. And Bismarck, through his contrived means of creating the new German Empire, was able to achieve that. And therefore, Wilhelm sort of owed him this, you know, undying loyalty, even though their relationship was exceptionally fraught. I mean, wonderful quote from Wilhelm: "It's been no easy thing to reign under you, Bismarck."
Yeah, that's a great one, isn't it? That's brilliant. I feel like sometimes there's kings or emperors or autocrats throughout history where Well, one springs to mind. I think he was actually sort of clinically slow or something. But the last king of Spain, just before Napoleon invaded, he delegated pretty much everything to his first minister. And he just spent all his time going out hunting mainly and just didn't care about the business of government. I don't think Wilhelm I he's not that, but he's in that vein, do you think, where he was probably happy on some level, otherwise why would he have done it, to give Bismarck so much authority?
I think that's quite a good comparison, actually, because I think the king you're referring to is Carlos the IV. And there was this wonderful episode where both he and his son, either Philip the VI or VII, someone can correct me, met the Emperor Napoleon at Bayonne. And the younger son was basically petitioning that, you know, I should replace my father. I would be a more loyal and effective king and ally to France. And then, of course, Napoleon believed, oh, you're both completely useless. I'm going to put my own older brother, Joseph, on the throne of Spain, just to indicate your point. But there are two aspects to that. One, the fact that Carlos the IV was a rather sort of, I would say the difference between Carlos the IV and Wilhelm I is that Wilhelm I had a profound sense of duty and was very much a soldier monarch, a monarch in this ancient mold. I mean, one of the sort of, you know, great things that was impressed upon him was the fact that he saw himself merely as a vassal of the Austrians, the Austrian emperor. And one thing that Bismarck really had to impose his will on the king was saying, no, you can be an emperor of Germany. You don't need the Austrians. We can defeat them. We can remove them and we won't have to play second fiddle to them once again. So I think in fairness to Wilhelm I was a very dutiful man with a great sense of fidelity. And I think when it comes to Carlos IV, an interesting aspect you bring up is this conflict between father and son. Because, of course, that was the exact same situation we see with Wilhelm I and his son, the emperor who reigns very briefly, Frederick III, who is very much under the influence of his British wife, the Princess Royal, the first child of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert, the Empress Victoria. Who very much wanted to create a system of government which was mimicking many aspects of British parliamentarianism with a form of constitutional rule. And of course, what ultimately happened is that Frederick III developed throat cancer towards the end of his father's life. And so when he did rule, it's called the Year of the Three Emperors, 1888, he couldn't speak. He was unable to speak throughout his entire reign. And so Wilhelm II prematurely becomes emperor, and Wilhelm II is brought up. You know, he's there's a lot of sort of study relating to his sort of early life, but needless to say, he and his mother did not have a good relationship. He very much hated his mother and everything he stood for. He resented aspects of his English upbringing, and so he surrounded himself with, you can say, to some extent, chauvinistic pro-Germans, pro-Prussians. And when he comes to his ascendance, when he ascends to the imperial throne in 1888, he very much wants to undo anything with any sort of aspect of his mother's influence and be a monarch very much in the style of his grandfather and not what his father could have potentially been.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.